Chapter 10. And nation are saved. From henceforth let the nightingale be honored throughout the land forever, and publish it among all the people, that whosoever shall insult a nightingale, or injure it, shall suffer death. The king hath spoken. All that little world was drunk with joy. The castle and the city blazed with bonfires all night long, the people danced, and drank and sang, and the triumphant clamor of the bells never ceased. From that day the nightingale was a sacred bird. Its song was heard in every house, the poets wrote its praises, the painters painted it, its sculptured image adorned every arch, and turret and fountain and public building. It was even taken into the king's councils, and no grave matter of state was decided until the soothsayers had laid the thing before the state nightingale and translated to the ministry what it was that the bird had sung about it. 2. The young king was very fond of the chase. When the summer was come he rode forth with hawk and hound, one day, in a brilliant company of his nobles. He got separated from them by and by, in a great forest, and took what he imagined a neat cut, to find them again, but it was a mistake. He rode on and on, hopefully at first, but with sinking courage finally. Twilight came on, and still he was plunging through a lonely and unknown land. Then came a catastrophe. In the dim light he forced his horse through a tangled thicket overhanging a steep and rocky declivity. When horse and rider reached the bottom, the former had a broken neck, and the latter a broken leg. The poor little king lay there suffering agonies of pain, and each hour seemed a long month to him. He kept his ear strained to heed any sound that might promise hope of rescue, but he heard no voice, no sound of horn or bay of hound. So at last he gave up all hope, and said, "Let death come, for come it must." Just then the deep, sweet song of a nightingale swept across the still wastes of the night. "Saved," the king said. "Saved. It is the sacred bird, and the prophecy is come true. The gods themselves protected me from error in the choice." He could hardly contain his joy, he could not word his gratitude. Every few moments, now he thought he caught the sound of approaching succor. But each time it was a disappointment. No succor came. The dull hours drifted on. Still no help came, but still the sacred bird sang on. He began to have misgivings about his choice, but he stifled them. Toward dawn the bird ceased. The morning came, and with it thirst and hunger, but no succor. The day waxed and waned. At last the king cursed the nightingale. Immediately the song of the thrush came from out the wood. The king said in his heart, "This was the true bird, my choice was false, succor will come now." But it did not come. Then he lay many hours insensible. When he came to himself, a linnet was singing. He listened with apathy. His faith was gone. "These birds," he said, "can bring no help. I and my house and my people are doomed." He turned him about to die, for he was grown very feeble from hunger and thirst and suffering, and felt that his end was near. In truth, he wanted to die, and be released from pain. For long hours he lay without thought or feeling or motion. Then his senses returned. The dawn of the third morning was breaking. Ah, the world seemed very beautiful to those worn eyes. Suddenly a great longing to live rose up in the lad's heart, and from his soul welled a deep and fervent prayer that heaven would have mercy upon him, and let him see his home and his friends once more. In that instant a soft, a faint, a far-off sound, but oh, how inexpressibly sweet to his waiting ear, came floating out of the distance. "Wow! Dot dot ee! Wow dot 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 ee! Wow ee! Wow ee! Wow ee!" That, oh, that song is sweeter, a thousand times sweeter than the voice of the nightingale, thrush, or linnet, for it brings not mere hope, but certainty of succor. And now, indeed, am I saved. The sacred singer has chosen itself, as the oracle intended. The prophecy is fulfilled, and my life, my house, and my people are redeemed. The ass shall be sacred from this day. The divine music grew nearer and nearer, stronger and stronger, and ever sweeter and sweeter to the perishing sufferer's ear. Down the declivity the docile little donkey wandered, cropping herbage and singing as he went. And when at last he saw the dead horse and the wounded king, he came and snuffed at them with simple and marveling curiosity. The king petted him, and he knelt down as had been his wont, when his little mistress desired to mount. With great labor and pain the lad drew himself upon the creature's back, and held himself there by aid of the generous ears. The ass went singing forth from the place, and carried the king to the little peasant maid's hut. She gave him her pallet for a bed, refreshed him with goat's milk, and then flew to tell the great news to the first scouting party of searchers she might meet. The king got well. His first act was to proclaim the sacredness and inviolability of the ass. His second was to add this particular ass to his cabinet, and make him chief minister of the crown. His third was to have all the statues and effigies of nightingales throughout his kingdom destroyed, and replaced by statues and effigies of the sacred donkey. And his fourth was to announce that, when the little peasant maid should reach her 15th year, he would make her his queen, and he kept his word. Such is the legend. This explains why the moldering image of the ass adorns all these old crumbling walls and arches. And it explains why, during many centuries, an ass was always the chief minister in that royal cabinet, just as is still the case in most cabinets to this day. And it also explains why, in that little kingdom, during many centuries, all great poems, all great speeches, all great books, all public solemnities, and all royal proclamations, always began with these stirring words. Wow. Dot dot e. Wow dot 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 e. Wow e. Wow e. Speech on the babies at the banquet in Chicago, given by the Army of the Tennessee to their first commander, General U.S. Grant, November, 1879. The 15th regular toast was, "Ye babies, as they comfort us in our sorrows, let us not forget them in our festivities." I like that. We have not all had the good fortune to be ladies. We have not all been generals, or poets, or statesmen. But when the toast works down to the babies, we stand on common ground. It is a shame that for 1,000 years the world's banquets have utterly ignored the baby, as if he didn't amount to anything. If you will stop and think a minute, if you will go back 50 or 100 years to your early married life, and recontemplate your first baby, you will remember that he amounted to a great deal, and even something over. You soldiers all know that, when the little fellow arrived at family headquarters, you had to hand in your resignation. He took entire command. You became his lackey, his mere body servant, and you had to stand around too. He was not a commander who made allowances for time, distance, weather, or anything else. You had to execute his order, whether it was possible or not. And there was only one form of marching in his manual of tactics, and that was the double quick. He treated you with every sort of insolence and disrespect, and the bravest of you didn't dare to say a word. You could face the death storm at Donelson and Vicksburg, and give back blow for blow, but when he clawed your whiskers, and pulled your hair, and twisted your nose, you had to take it. When the thunders of war were sounding in your ears, you set your faces toward the batteries, and advanced with steady tread. But when he turned on the terrors of his war whoop, you advanced in the other direction, and mighty glad of the chance to. When he called for soothing syrup, did you venture to throw out any side remarks about certain services, being unbecoming an officer and a gentleman? No. You got up and got it. When he ordered his pap-dash bottle, and it was not warm, did you talk back? Not you. You went to work and warmed it. You even descended so far in your menial office as to take a suck at that warm, insipid stuff yourself, to see if it was right, 3 parts water to 1 of milk, a touch of sugar to modify the colic, and a drop of peppermint to kill those hiccups. I can taste that stuff yet. And how many things you learned as you went along. Sentimental young folks still take stock in that beautiful old saying that when the baby smiles in his sleep, it is because the angels are whispering to him. Very pretty, but too thin, simply wind on the stomach, my friends. If the baby proposed to take a walk at his usual hour, 2 o'clock in the morning, didn't he rise up promptly and remark, with a mental addition which would not improve a Sunday school book much, that that was the very thing you were about to propose yourself? Oh, you were under good discipline, and as you went fluttering up and down the room in your undress uniform, you not only prattled undignified baby talk, but even tuned up your martial voices and tried to sing. Okay, my baby in the treetop, for instance. What a spectacle for an Army of the Tennessee. And what an affliction for the neighbors too. For it is not everybody within a mile around that likes military music at 3 in the morning. And when you had been keeping this sort of thing up 2 or 3 hours, and your little velvet head intimated that nothing suited him like exercise and noise, what did you do? Oh, on. You simply went on until you dropped in the last ditch. The idea that a baby doesn't amount to anything. Why, one baby is just a house, and a front yard full by itself. One baby can furnish more business than you, and your whole interior department can attend to. He is enterprising, irrepressible, brimful of lawless activities. Do what you please, you can't make him stay on the reservation. Sufficient unto the day is one baby. As long as you are in your right mind, don't you ever pray for twins. Twins amount to a permanent riot. And there ain't any real difference between triplets and an insurrection. Yes, it was high time for a toastmaster to recognize the importance of the babies. Think what is in store for the present crop. 50 years from now we shall all be dead, I trust, and then this flag, if it still survive, and let us hope it may, will be floating over a republic numbering 200,000,000 souls, according to the settled laws of our increase. Our present schooner of state will have grown into a political leviathan, a Great Eastern. The cradled babies of today will be on deck. Let them be well trained, for we are going to leave a big contract on their hands. Among the 3 or 4 million cradles now rocking in the land are some which this nation would preserve for ages as sacred things, if we could know which ones they are. In one of them cradles the unconscious Farragut of the future, is at this moment teething, think of it. And putting in a world of dead earnest, unarticulated, but perfectly justifiable profanity over it too. In another the future renowned astronomer is blinking at the shining Milky Way with, but a languid interest, poor little chap, and wondering what has become of that other one they call the wet nurse. In another the future great historian is lying and doubtless will continue to lie until his earthly mission is ended. In another the future president is busying himself with no profounder problem of state than what the mischief has become of his hair so early. And in a mighty array of other cradles there are now some 60,000 future office seekers, getting ready to furnish him occasion to grapple with that same old problem a second time. And in still one more cradle, somewhere under the flag, the future illustrious commander in dash chief of the American armies is so little burdened with his approaching grandeurs and responsibilities, as to be giving his whole strategic mind at this moment to trying to find out some way to get his big toe into his mouth, an achievement which, meaning no disrespect, the illustrious guest of this evening turned his entire attention to some 56 years ago. And if the child is but a prophecy of the man, there are mighty few who will doubt that he succeeded. Speech on the weather at the New England Society's 71st annual dinner, New York City. The next toast was colon the oldest inhabitant, the weather of New England. Who can lose it and forget it? Who can have it and regret it? The interposes twixt us twain. Merchant of Venice. To this Samuel 50. Clemens, Mark Twain, replied as follows. I reverently believe that the maker who made us all makes everything in New England but the weather. I don't know who makes that, but I think it must be raw apprentices in the weather clerk's factory who experiment and learn how, in New England, for board and clothes, and then are promoted to make weather for countries that require a good article, and will take their custom elsewhere if they don't get it. There is a sumptuous variety about the New England weather that compels the stranger's admiration and regret. The weather is always doing something there, always attending strictly to business, always getting up new designs and trying them on the people, to see how they will go. But it gets through more business in spring than in any other season. In the spring I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 24 hours. It was I that made the fame and fortune of that man, that had that marvelous collection of weather on exhibition at the Centennial, that so astounded the foreigners. He was going to travel all over the world, and get specimens from all the climes. I said, "Don't you do it. You come to New England on a favorable spring day." I told him what we could do in the way of style, variety, and quantity. Well, he came and he made his collection in 4 days. As to variety, why, he confessed that he got hundreds of kinds of weather that he had never heard of before. And as to quantity, well, after he had picked out and discarded all that was blemished in any way, he not only had weather enough, but weather to spare, weather to hire out, weather to sell, to deposit, weather to invest, weather to give to the poor. The people of New England are by nature patient and forbearing, but there are some things which they will not stand. Every year they kill a lot of poets for writing about odorful spring. These are generally casual visitors, who bring their notions of spring from somewhere else, and cannot, of course, know how the natives feel about spring. And so the first thing they know the opportunity to inquire how they feel has permanently gone by. Old Probabilities has a mighty reputation for accurate prophecy, and thoroughly well deserves it. You take up the paper, and observe how crisply and confidently he checks off what today's weather is going to be on the Pacific, down south, in the Middle States, in the Wisconsin region. See him sail along in the joy and pride of his power till he gets to New England, and then see his tail drop. He doesn't know what the weather is going to be in New England. Well, he mulls over it, and by he gets out something about like this. Probable northeast to southwest winds, varying to the southward, and westward and eastward, and points between, high and low barometer swapping around from place to place. Probable areas of rain, snow, hail, and drought, succeeded or preceded by earthquakes, with thunder and lightning. Then he jots down this postscript from his wandering mind, to cover accidents. But it is possible that the program may be wholly changed in the meantime. Yes, one of the brightest gems in the New England weather is the dazzling uncertainty of it. There is only one thing certain about it. You are certain there is going to be plenty of it, a perfect grand review, but you never can tell which end of the procession is going to move first. You fix up for the drought, you leave your umbrella in the house and sally out, and 2-1 you get drowned. You make up your mind that the earthquake is due, you stand from under and take hold of something to steady yourself, and the first thing you know you get struck by lightning. These are great disappointments, but they can't be helped. The lightning there is peculiar. It is so convincing that when it strikes a thing it doesn't leave enough of that thing behind for you to tell whether, well, you'd think it was something valuable, and a congressman had been there. And the thunder. When the thunder begins to merely tune up and scrape and saw, and key up the instruments for the performance, strangers say, "Why, what awful thunder you have here." But when the baton is raised, and the real concert begins, you'll find that stranger down in the cellar with his head in the ash barrel. Now as to the size of the weather in New England lengthways, I mean, it is utterly disproportioned to the size of that little country. Half the time, when it is packed as full as it can stick, you will see that New England weather sticking out beyond the edges and projecting around hundreds and hundreds of miles over the neighboring states. She can't hold a tenth part of her weather. You can see cracks. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.